This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I am your host, Samantha Lam, for the New Books Network Russia and Eurasian Studies channel. Today we're talking with Yoram Gorlitsky about the book he co-authored, Substate Dictatorship, Network Loyalty, and Institutional Change in the Soviet Union. So, Yoram, would you like to say a couple of words about yourself?
Thank you very much, Samantha. Yes, despite my rather exotic name, I was born in London, and apart from a short spell in Israel, was raised and educated in England. I began my PhD more or less exactly when Mikhail Gorbachev came to power, and it was the excitement around perestroika that really drew me to learning Russian and to the study of Soviet politics. Although my doctorate was in a school of social sciences, my research topics have always been historical, and it's that creative tension between being in a social sciences department and studying historical topics, which is, I think, reflected in this book.
So let's start with some basic definitions. How do you define substate dictatorship, and why is this topic worthy of study?
Okay, well, I'll take those sort of questions in order. In terms of definition, a substate dictatorship is a local or regional dictatorship that is lodged in a statewide authoritarian regime. Broadly speaking, a dictatorship is a regime whose rulers come to power by means other than competitive elections. And this applies both at the state and substate levels. In the book, we then go beyond this by applying other recent findings in the theory of dictatorship to the Soviet case.
And so why is this topic really important to study?
Well, there is, I think, an understandable fascination around the world with leaders, and in particular with the personality of dictators. In our view, however, this can only take you so far. We believe that in order to understand how a dictatorship really works, we need to find out what's going on within the state and to penetrate its inner workings. And in a country as large as the Soviet Union, these were predominantly located at the local level.
So Getty wrote a book not too long ago called Practicing Stalinism, Bolsheviks, Boyars, and the Persistence of Tradition, which also looks at these sort of regional power networks and patron-client relationships. How does your work mesh with his? Do you challenge some of his ideas? Do you expand on some of his thoughts?
Well, in the book, we do engage quite fully with Getty's work, which does appear several times in the bibliography. But Practicing Stalinism offers arguments which are so much at variance with our findings that engaging with it would have taken us on a major detour. So perhaps this is actually a good opportunity for us to spell out what the differences are. First of all, Getty sees quite major continuities in types of regime and political practice over time, ones which run through centuries, connecting the Middle Ages and the Stalin era. We see things very differently. We posit a fundamental break between pre-revolutionary forms of monarchical dictatorship and the one-party dictatorship that existed under the Bolsheviks. The institutions and everyday working practices were, in other words, as far as we can see them, fundamentally different. Secondly, Getty believes that patrimonial practices took precedence over institutional ones in the Soviet era. We argue this is really quite wrong. The Soviet system, in our view, was highly institutionalized. It's just a matter of working out exactly what these institutions were and discerning the institutional patterns that were inscribed in everyday life. Getty uses primarily Weberian categories, like sort of rational bureaucracy and patrimonial leadership. We use a completely different set of categories drawn from the literature and comparative social science. categories which we believe better enable us to compare the Soviet system with other political systems.
So do you disagree with his idea that there were family circles that ruled in the regions and that these sort of personal trust relationships were important?
Yes, we think that that there were networks, but that it's wrong to see networks as kind of uniform and as we're taking the same, we're assuming the same form in every region. We believe that it's quite possible to compare varieties from region to region, and that's one of the things that we try to do, that we try to do in the book. We also think that the kinds of networks that existed in the Soviet era were really fundamentally different from the networks that we find in earlier periods. And they're very closely connected to the organization of the state and to the rhythms of state campaigns and to the nature of the party at the local level and party apparatus and so forth.
So you do talk about the devolution of power from Moscow, particularly from Stalin, to these regional bodies, you know, simply because of the size of the Soviet Union. You know, Moscow cannot control everything. What sort of checks and balances did Stalin use to keep regional bosses and these sort of family circles in check?
Yeah, I mean, he had, and in this sense, we find that Stalin was actually much more kind of methodical in terms of his understanding of the relationship between the center and the provinces than any of his successors. He's actually understands that it's a problem, and he understands that you need kind of institutional devices to deal with it. And he comes up with a number of devices, the most important of which are probably regional party elections, which provide him with information about things that are going wrong within the regions as far as the center is concerned. They provide him with very, very valuable information about the inner workings of the regional party apparatus.
Could you explain that? Because most people view Soviet elections in general as fake. They think that they have just simply a slate of pre-approved candidates and that they are meaningless. How would party elections provide Stalin with information?
So what you have from 1947 onwards are regional party elections where members of the Obcom and the delegates who are sent to the regional party conferences are given a list of candidates. Now, they have no choice. So it's not as if they can choose between rival candidates for a position. But what they could do was to reject a candidate. And what we found was that in the elections, the regional party elections of 1947 and 1948, there were quite a large number of regions where you had major rebellions. Very often they were directed at the regional party first secretary, but sometimes also at other party secretaries or even the chair of the regional executive committee or other local notables and dignitaries. And this provided the center with information that something was going on in the region. And it very often this information departed from the official line that the region was following. And as a result, the center would very often send out brigades to check up on what was going on. And in some cases, they would actually fire a regional secretary, possibly even a regional first secretary, if they performed particularly badly in these elections. So they were, this is one of the findings of the book, these elections were actually very important and very meaningful, so meaningful that regional party secretaries changed their behavior in response to them. And we know that because, first of all, we can see that in terms of their speeches and their relationships with the Obcoms. But also it's very interesting that the number of rebellions diminishes from 1947, 1948 onwards. And we think this is partly as a result of their response to these signals that they're getting from the local party committees.
I'm actually not really surprised by this, because when I look at the constitution and the subsequent elections in 36 and 37, at the local level, people are encouraged to vote out people who are grossly incompetent or otherwise not doing their job. And Stalin does actually encourage this. So using these elections as signals to who is doing their job poorly appears to go back to at least 36. But you say they change their behavior, these Obkom first secretaries. Are they changing their behavior in relation to their subordinates? Are they changing their behavior on how they implement state policy? What changes exactly are they making to avoid losing their jobs?
Yeah, so it's both, really. I think the most important thing is that in the immediate aftermath of the war, they're quite kind of unforgiving, quite brutal in terms of their relationship, in particular to the Reichom first secretaries. And when these Reichom first secretaries and other members of the wider regional elite begins to kind of vote against them, sometimes in large numbers, they realize that they need to come to some kind of accommodation with the first secretaries, with the Reichom first secretaries, and very often other officials from the Reichoms. And so they come to compromises with them, and they also soften their language. They become a little bit less relentless, I suppose, in terms of their implementation of certain campaigns, because they realize they need to keep these local leaders on side.
And so is it a realization that the local leaders simply don't have the resources to implement these campaigns?
I think that's less of an issue for them. I think what they want is, because they always know that the local leaders don't have the resources, but they still need to meet their targets, which is to say that the regional leaders need to meet their targets. But what they realize is they need to come to some kind of compromise with them, because if they don't, then they will tattle, they will defect the center, they will inform the center of various things that are going on in the region, but particularly through these elections.
So are they creating essentially protection networks where if you don't snitch on me, I won't snitch on you, and Moscow will never know we didn't actually do this?
Yeah, I mean, that's what they want to do. It doesn't always work out that way. What we find is that probably the most important thing for them is to keep their inner circle in line, because the inner circle, the members of the regional party bureau, are privy to information which could be very, very damaging to them. And that's probably their most important goal in maintaining their regional political regimes. So one of the things we show in the book is that there is a kind of systemic difference in terms of their relationship to local elites, which is to say to their local inner circles, and their relationship with the Reichom party secretaries, who are kind of one level below.
And of course, Moscow's role in all of this is to find what they're hiding, right, to more effectively manage the information they're getting and the implementation of policy. So this would really put the regional elites and Moscow at odds, would it not?
Well, one of the things that we argue in the book is that by and large, Moscow is quite happy to leave most regional leaders to their own discretion. So that regional leaders on the whole are allowed to run their regions as they see fit, for normally a fixed term of around 5 or 6 years. And it's this that allows them to become sub-state dictators. It's only if the regional leader does something which is particularly bad, particularly egregious, that Moscow will intervene. And we give one or two examples of this. And sometimes it will be in response to an electoral revolt, because this will be a signal to the center that something has gone fundamentally wrong in the region.
So is this different from the 30s when Moscow really did care, particularly if people were not implementing policy successfully? I see this with the Constitution, where they send in rebukes that they were not gathering, you know, information, the suggestions and stuff correctly, and that Moscow was not receiving these in a timely manner. You see this with other campaigns where, you know, they're not pleased with the way things are being implemented, and they start, you know, this is what Getty argues is the root of the purge, is that Moscow is not getting a responsive, you know, action from these regional committees. Does this change?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I think there are certain continuities. So Moscow is very, very interested in ensuring that that the plans are implemented and that the policies are carried through. But there are important differences. I mean, of course, in the 1930s, and I suppose this is one area where we would really disagree with Getty, the center is very keen to, certainly by the end of the 1930s, to purge these regional leaders because they present a potential threat to the center and to Stalin, particularly in the event of a war. That isn't an issue by the late 1940s because these leaders are much younger, they're much more junior, and this is a very traditional society. So they don't really pose a threat to Stalin in any kind of major way. I think the continuity lies in the fact that the center is still very interested in making sure that the campaigns, that the policies are implemented. What it doesn't want is for the campaigns to be implemented on paper, but in fact, on the ground, a lot of the things that regional leaders claim to be happening aren't really happening. That's the thing that they want to use, among other things, the regional party elections as sources of information about these goings on in the regions.
That's always the issue with the Soviet bureaucracy, though, isn't it? That, you know, what exists on paper and what happens in real life are often not at all the same thing.
Sure, yeah. I mean, what we find is that over time, there are a number of kind of institutional practices which become kind of consolidated. And these don't really exist in the mid-1930s, but they become consolidated by the late 1940s. Early 1950s, and these are designed precisely in order to narrow down the wriggle room that's available to local leaders to falsify statistics, to make out that plans are being implemented whereas in fact they aren't. So by the late 1940s, the system has become much more institutionalized than it had been in the 30s in that regard.
Are those measures actually effective, though? Because you certainly write, for example, about Ryazan, which I know is a little bit later in the Khrushchev era, where that is a massive falsification of statistics. I mean, he's essentially at that point buying meat products and then running them through as if you're meeting like extra meat quotas and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So are these measures effective?
Yeah. If you compare Stalin and Khrushchev, what we would argue is that that Stalin's devices are much, much more effective than either Khrushchev's or Brezhnev's, because Stalin seems to have a much better understanding of how this regime works, how the political system works than Khrushchev does. And it's to that end that he sets up all these institutional mechanisms to control regional elites. What Khrushchev does, and the scandal that you're referring to is it takes place in 1960, is to dismantle all these control mechanisms. And we argue that is an absolute disaster because Khrushchev fails to understand the kind of fundamental truth about this system, which is that you can't rely on regional leaders both to implement policies and to tell the truth about whether they've been implemented. That you need You need third-party agencies, truth-tellers, honest brokers to provide this information. And what Khrushchev does is to dismantle all of these, which is an absolute catastrophe. And that leads in the late 1950s to a pandemic of falsification and fraud, which we can't be absolutely certain about this, but it appears to us to be on a far greater scale than at any other point in Soviet history.
So other than regional elections, what other mechanisms did Stalin implement to keep an eye on regional leaders and, you know, make sure they were doing what they said they were doing?
Yeah, there are two other kinds of mechanisms that we look at in the book. The first are rotations. So what you have is a system where regional leaders are given kind of more or less absolute power to run their regions as they saw fit, but only for a particular period, only for a fixed term of normally around 5 to 6 years. And then resuming a policy which had first been introduced in the 1920s, you have a kind of mechanism for rotating leaders from one region to another. And that's one way of controlling these leaders and making sure that their connection to local networks doesn't become overly sort of nepotistic. The other mechanism, the third type of mechanism, are various institutions such as Ministry of State Control and the Party Control Commission, which again are consolidated and become kind of entrenched in the late Stalin era. And what Khrushchev does disastrously is to undercut these institutions to try and to devolve as much power as possible to regional party leaders. And we think this in terms of his ability to control what's going on at the regional level, this is a catastrophe.
Why would Khrushchev make that decision to devolve power?
Yeah, Khrushchev had a very kind of childlike and quite naive understanding of how organizations work. So he responded to bureaucracy in a very kind of common sense way. I think his idea was that one should deal with it simply by removing paperwork. And the best way of doing this was to transfer power from the central ministries and the central party organizations, which had become kind of overwhelmed with bureaucracy, and transfer power to the region. So he thought this would be enough. But it was based on a fundamental misunderstanding of how institutions, how organizations actually function. And by contrast, Stalin was actually had a much better understanding, much better sort of sense of the internal dynamics of institutions. And this probably goes back to Stalin's own experience in the Central Committee in the 1920s.
So how does the mechanism, could you give us a time frame of these changes in the mechanisms of regional governments? Because there is sort of a messy transition from Stalin's death to actually Malenkov, then to Khrushchev, as far as, you know, state power goes. How is this reflected in change to regional governments?
Yeah, I mean, we have a kind of a chapter in the book which looks at the interregnum between Stalin and Khrushchev. And we argue that there was a short period of around, well, a few months, when you had two kind of rival models of governance, one represented by Khrushchev, which was basically a kind of a form of governance that's based on party rule, and the other that's championed by Beria, who in effect is relying on the local committees, local leadership of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, which itself depends on various forms of kompromat in order to run the country.
And would you like to explain what kompromat is for our non-Russian speaking listeners?
Sure, yes. So kompromat is just the use of compromising materials. So any information that can be used to discredit an individual in the light of the authorities. It discredits an individual against. To discredit an individual. So, for example, in the late Stalin era, one of the favoured forms of kompromat was to show that an individual was associated with some kind of oppositional activity. It could be Trotskyists, or it could be émigrés, or it could be whites from the Civil War. One of the things that we argue is that under Khrushchev, you get a transition from relying on kompromat, which was based on association with oppositional activity, to a new form of kompromat that was based on involvement in the repressions under Stalin. So kompromat is basically the use of information that can be used to discredit usually a rival within the leadership.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Okay. And you also note that the regional cadre makeup changes significantly from the 1930s through the 1950s. And this isn't necessarily surprising, given the repressions of the 30s and then the massive death toll of World War II. But why is this important?
Yeah, what we argue is that there are two main kind of changes that that take place from the 1930s to the 1950s. So first of all, there's a greater seniority of person, as we call it. This means that the higher you are in the regional party hierarchy, the more likely you were to be older and to have greater levels of expertise and education. And this is quite different from the situation in the late 30s, when the highest regional leaders were normally very young and relatively inexperienced. And secondly, there was seniority of office. This meant that one's position in the hierarchy was carefully calibrated with levels of pay and prestige. So from the 30s to the 50s, the system has become increasingly stratified and hierarchical. Why is this important? These two changes were significant because they were associated with the consolidation of status hierarchies. And beyond what happens with institutions, which is one of the things that we're primarily interested in the book, it's these changes in society that are probably the most important driver behind the new type of regional regime that emerges in the 60s and 70s.
Okay, another focus of your book is sub-state nationalism, which I think is quite interesting. How do you define that, and how is it different from older Stalinist-era programs such as Koronizatsiya, which also produce a ruling class in minority publics, primarily made up of members of these minorities who also often had nationalistic ambitions?
Yeah, sub-state nationalism is the articulation of demands for ethnic self-government at the regional or sub-state rather than the state-wide level. So in that sense, Karenizatsiya, which involves the kind of cultivation of local elites and the promotion of local languages, local constitutions, it is something that actually works against sub-state dictatorship, sub-state nationalism. So Karenizatsiya and sub-state nationalism originally were moving kind of opposite directions. Karenizatsiya was an attempt by the regime to prevent sub-state nationalism, but we also acknowledge that the two were connected. And alongside an earlier generation of scholars, we argue that over the long term, Karenizatsiya did actually contribute to sub-state nationalism.
And what nations isn't probably quite the right word, but what republics were these nationalistic feelings or movements particularly strong in?
So in the mid-50s, probably the most radical cases were Azerbaijan and Latvia, where sub-state national movements focused on the issue of language. But one could also point to what one might think of, and I sympathize with you when it comes to the terminology, but we could think of them as proto-national movements in Georgia in 1956, in Lithuania in the 1970s, as well as in some other republics such as Ukraine and Armenia.
And what form did sub-state nationalism take? Was it only agitation for greater linguistic rights, or were there other aspects as well?
Yeah, in the mid-1950s, the main focus was language. But you do get other examples. So in Georgia in 1956, the attacks on Stalin are interpreted by many Georgians as a slight on the Georgian nation. And there is an argument that that the demonstrations against Khrushchev's secret speech in 1956 are a kind of the first flickerings, the first signs of a proto-national movement in Georgia. In other areas, you get, it might not be a particular individual or even the language, but it might be the ethnic group's history or its kind of culture more broadly that that comes up for scrutiny. And perhaps the indigenous or the local ethnic group will campaign on behalf of kind of raising the profile of the local culture, the local ethnic culture, or perhaps kind of playing up the ethnic group's role in a major historical event such as the Second World War.
So how did these republics also use nationalist discourse to resolve internal problems? Because you do talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, we argue that the republic bureaucracies were in a bit of a bind. To keep Moscow happy, they had to toe the party line. At the same time, in order to have some kind of semblance of credibility with local elites and the broader population, they needed to communicate in an idiom the local population could understand and relate to. And this sometimes meant promoting the local language or trumpeting one's local history and culture. But this tension was ultimately kind of irresolvable. We don't argue that local elites used nationalist discourse to resolve internal policy problems. More, they used national mobilization as a means of bolstering their own position. If that meant resolving internal policy problems, then so much the better.
And how did this shift to a nationalist discourse affect their relationship with Moscow?
Yeah, I mean, there was a kind of a gradual shift over time. I wouldn't go so far as to say that there was actually a shift towards a nationalist discourse. I don't think that would have been permitted by Moscow, but it was perhaps a national discourse. And what we find is that the republics and republican elites, they had to tread very carefully because on the one hand, they wanted to keep Moscow on side. But on the other hand, if they were going to do their job properly, they needed the cooperation of the local population. And they could only do that if they expressed themselves in a local idiom that the local population could relate to and understand.
So it seems to me that you've noted that a lot of these tendencies and problems begin with Khrushchev. You talked specifically about his de-Stalinization being a sticky wicket in Georgia. Did his anti-colonial policies in any way embolden these sort of proto-nationalist discourses?
Well, it's difficult to be absolutely certain because what happens under Khrushchev is that for a while he continues the policies that had been supported by Beria in his bid for power, which rely to a greater extent on colonization or indigenization. Because this is part of his kind of attempt to wind down the Stalinist system and to lower levels of repression and to make sort of communication the ability to publish a little bit easier in the mid-1950s. But in 1959, there is a kind of, he comes to a crunch point where he realizes that this is all getting out of hand. And it's at that stage that he authorizes a purge in Latvia. And there is a kind of a change in position. There's a change in direction in terms of the regime's nationalities policy, but it's not as pronounced as it looks if it would be from the perspective of 1959-1960.
When you say purge, though, you don't mean Stalinist purge where people get shot, right?
No, that's right. Yeah, you don't. I mean, that's one of the kind of important kind of long-term developments that we actually find that already in the Stalin era. That there's in terms of regional elites, there's much less of a chance of blood purges, of people being executed and arrested if they're members of a regional political elite.
Well, I'm sure they find that comforting.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think from the perspective, I think there were very, very high levels of fear, clearly, in the late 1940s. But if one looks at the actual dynamics of political rule, then what you get, this is one of the things that we tried to describe in chapters 2 and 3, is the emergence of practices from the bottom up, which are used to protect regional elites from kind of onslaughts from the center. And I should also say that I don't think it would be right, you know, to blame Khrushchev entirely for everything that went wrong. I mean, a lot of the kind of the underlying problems were there as it were from the very beginning, and they were clearly there also in the Stalin era. So there were many things about how Stalin kind of ruled the country, whatever one thinks about it from a kind of moral point of view, that were just completely unsustainable. So I think Khrushchev realized that he needed to do some things different, but unfortunately he made some catastrophic errors.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say I would blame him. I just think it's interesting to look at how things change. I mean, Stalin, even with the blood purges, was not successful at getting a responsive bureaucracy that implemented policy the way they were supposed to. You just end up with a bunch of dead people and bureaucracy that still doesn't work.
Sure, yeah. I mean, in general, one of the kind of the overall arguments that we make is that, in particular, in terms of the relationship between the center and the regions, there's actually a lot of continuity between the Stalin and Khrushchev eras, in the sense that both Stalin and Khrushchev placed regional leaders under extraordinary amounts of pressure, whereas the real cutoff point is in the early 1960s between Khrushchev and Brezhnev. In a sense, what Brezhnev says is, you know, I'm going to go easy a little bit on regional leaders, and I'm going to lower some of the pressure that you've been experiencing, and create kind of higher levels of certainty and continuity at the regional level.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that many of the demands on regional leaders were impossible, and that is some of the reason you see for things like falsification. So would we like to talk about, Khrushchev's reform, his devolution, and, you know, why these things failed, perhaps by looking specifically at Riazan? Because I think that's a very interesting example. And I loved your article on it, by the way.
Thanks, yeah. I mean, Riazan is a very interesting case. And actually, we argue that it's really a turning point in over the whole period, you know, from from the mid-1940s to the mid-1970s. What happens there is that you get a trust network that emerges between Larionov, the first secretary in Ryazan, and a group of local first secretaries and a couple of members of his Obcom bureau. And this forms over a decade. And it's this trust network, relatively high levels of trust between Larionov and this kind of coterie, this inner clique, that enables the really massive levels of falsification that you get in Ryazan. By contrast, you know, when we look at Kirov, which I know, Samantha, is where you are at the moment, you get a leader who's much more in the mold of the classic Stalinist substate dictator. So he's just applying kind of very high levels of pressure relentlessly on the Reichom secretaries. And that means it's very difficult for him to establish relations of trust with these leaders. And it means that when he himself has to falsify and has to lie on behalf, as it were, of the plan, he can't get the leaders to go along with him because they just don't trust him. So there's a marked contrast between the Ryazan and Kirov examples in that regard.
Well, I got the impression that a lot of that was personal, that in Ryazan, the first secretary was actually a pretty decent guy. People actually liked him. You have photographs, for example, of his funeral when he committed suicide, of, you know, just masses of people, you know, coming out to still support him. Whereas I got the impression the guy in Kirov was what we might colloquially call a douche. That he was in general not a nice person. And so, you know, this personality was really important.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, we're kind of reluctant to go down that route because we don't think it's simply a matter of of personality. If you look at Larionov in Ryazan, in the mid-1950s, sometimes he could occasionally behave very badly towards his subordinates. And in order to fulfill the 1959 plan, you had a kind of reversion to the raids and the strong arm tactics of the 1930s. And that's not, I think, commensurate with the idea of him as a nice guy. So I don't think in general, what we're not really trying to do is to reduce this all to a matter of, you know, of character or individual psychology, but rather to the kind of the dynamics as they evolve over time, the relationships between a first secretary and members of his inner elite or members of the wider elite, the Reichom secretaries. And that's not really a matter of niceness, but it's a matter of his strategy for rule. And in that regard, we think that that Larionov's is very, very different from Chelyakov's, the first secretary in Kirov.
Would you mind telling our listeners what exactly they were falsifying, how badly it was falsified, and why they would do that?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's quite a kind of an involved story, but towards the end of 1958, Khrushchev announces for the first time there's going to be a seven-year plan rather than a five-year plan with extraordinarily ambitious targets right across the board, but in particular in one or two areas, including the procurement targets for meat. And the reason for this was that it was important for Khrushchev to try and match the United States, which was at the time the main kind of geopolitical rival to the Soviet Union. So Khrushchev begins by sending an emissary to Ryazan to negotiate with the first secretary there to increase the plan threefold, from 50,000 tons to 150,000 tons of meat. And what that involves is a whole range of completely perverse and irrational practices, such as going to Moscow and buying up meat in stores, sometimes in secondary markets. But also there's a lot of falsification. So sometimes you'll have meat that is double counted. In certain areas, you'll get meat that is slaughtered this year being counted for the following year as well, or meat that is being fattened up this year being counted towards the next year's target. And in other cases, and this is the most sort of extreme form of falsification, you get the fabrication, the complete fabrication of documents referring to the meat that simply didn't exist.
Did they stand any chance of actually implementing the plan had they worked hard and grown lots of cows and pigs and sheep? Was this something that they could have done without falsification?
No. To go from 50,000 tons to 150,000 was, it wasn't utopian. It was a completely mad idea. That there was no way, given the cattle reserves in the region, that could have been achieved. It's an interesting moment because a lot of the officials in Ryazan realized that this was a completely crazy idea. And what they also realized that it couldn't work in the long term, because if you had a very high plan this year, you'd need to have, through the kind of what was known as ratchet effect, you'd need to have an even higher plan the next year. And that was completely unsustainable. It could never have been achieved. It has to be said, and again, this is one of the points we make in the book, that when Khrushchev is eventually toppled, that the kind of refrain that you get in the Central Committee plenum in 1964, the thing that keeps on coming up again and again, is the Ryazan scandal and how crazy it was, how mad it was even to try to achieve it in the first place, but then also to support the levels of deception at the regional level that had been the case in 1960. So it was completely kind of impractical idea, and it could never really been achieved, this particular goal.
That's sort of what I thought. You see this in the 30s too, when I look at Kirov Raikom secretaries. They're implementing flax plans and stuff that they simply, there's no way that they have grown that much flax. And so they do things like breaking into people's houses and stealing the flax out of their comforters, or sending them to the collective farm market to buy flax and turn it in as if they've grown it. So this is not necessarily new. And I do think it is a result of the absolutely irrational demands placed on them.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Harrison, a scholar at Warwick, wrote a very interesting article trying to assess levels of falsification over time. And of course, falsification, is kind of, it's woven into the fabric of the Soviet economic system and political system. But what he shows is that there is a really a massive increase in the 1950s, and it reaches a crescendo in 1960. So although you get this in the 30s, you get this in the 60s, you get this in the 70s and 80s, that there is something that happens in this period that leads to a steep rise and eventually the catastrophe in Ryazan.
So do you think the Ryazan scandal directly contributed to Khrushchev's downfall?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, I think it's really at that point that that you get a turning against him on the part of the Central Committee Presidium, because what they know is that he's lied. What he claims at the beginning of 1961 is that that Ryazan should never have even come up with this idea of three plans. But it should have stuck to two plans, and I have to say that is, from from his point of view, it was completely outrageous, because the only reason they went for three plans was because they were put under impossible pressure from him to do that. But what members of the Presidium actually discovered was that Razan, even with all the pressure that was applied to it, only supplied 60,000 tons. It couldn't even get to 100,000. And so they realized that basically Khrushchev, because he'd invested so much political capital in the Razan campaign, and he'd been to Razan in February 1959, and he hosted a very glitzy reception for Razan farmers and milkmaids and so on in December 1959, because he'd invested so much capital in this, it really, really kind of eroded his credibility. And absolutely, yes, it did contribute to his downfall.
Did they also think he was a bit of an idiot for believing that they had successfully completed these plans?
Well, we don't know whether he actually believed that they did. I mean, he probably wasn't really that interested in whether they really did. I think what he wanted to do was at least to maintain the facade that they did. And there came a point in the autumn of 1960 when he realized that even maintaining those sorts of lies was completely unsustainable.
And so how does the Brezhnev period break from, you know, this Khrushchevian sort of Kafkaesque nightmare? You had mentioned that Brezhnev, you know, took it easier on the regional secretaries. Were there other important changes he implemented?
Yeah. Brezhnev, first of all, he reduces the pressure quite markedly on regional leaders. But then he embarks on a campaign for trust in cadres, which involves giving regional leaders much greater discretion to run affairs as they saw fit. And then he does a couple of kind of closely related policies which he pursues. The first is that he lets regional leaders stay in their region for as long as they want, more or less. So whereas under Stalin and Khrushchev, regional leaders normally would serve a term, a fixed term of around 5 years, and then move on to another region. Under Brezhnev, you know, sometimes they'll stay in the same oblast or the same krai for 10, 15, 20 years. And alongside that, he does away with the policy of rotation, of kind of rotating these regional leaders from one region to another. And he also stops the previous practice of sending officials from the Central Committee to lord it, to rule over these regional party committees. Another general kind of policy that he pursues is to widen the policy of indigenization. So he allows regional leaders to recruit from within their own regions, and to engage in a process of what we call homeland nationalism. So even within the Russian Federation, regional leaders are allowed not so much to promote a separate language, but certainly to promote kind of local history, local museums.
Krajevidenie?
A form of Krajevidenie, exactly. And that, again, is something that's quite new. And it involves a transfer and an enlargement of indigenization, which previously had been practiced only in the Union Republics, to the regional level within the Russian Republic as well.
So what would you say the main takeaway you want our listeners to have from your book is?
Well, I think one of the main points is that I think most people tend to think of dictatorship as political regimes in which leaders are all powerful. And one of the things that we try to do in the book is to maintain a distinction between authoritarian regimes and democracies, while acknowledging that for authoritarian regimes to work, the leader, no matter how powerful, has to find some way of institutionalizing the transfer of power to regional leaders. And secondly, we argue that in order to understand how dictatorships change, the key thing is not so much to focus on abrupt events or shocks such as revolutions, wars, or the death of the dictator, but on how these regimes change from within. And this is a process that occurs incrementally or gradually. So we see that it already is beginning to happen under Stalin, and it's a process that cuts across the changes of administration in the Kremlin.
Well, thank you for coming and talking to us about your new book. Are you working on another project now, or are you taking a little rest?
I've got a couple of other projects. There's one on the Soviet legal system, actually, which ties in with your own work, Samantha, on constitutions and how they were interpreted by justice officials of the late 1940s, early 50s. And then there's another book that I'm working on with Oleg Hrevnyuk again. We're going to be looking at the Brezhnev era and the Perestroika era. And we're looking at the role of ideology and how it changed.
Well, those sound interesting. When you get them finished, let us know, and we'd love to have you back again.
Thank you very much, Samantha. And thank you very much for having me on the network.